Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Emma Hines about her historical novel, The Knowing. Emma has a master's in creative writing from the University of St Andrews and has settled in Manchester, where she's a queer playwright and novelist. Emma is prolifically known online in the fanfiction community, keeping up with her followers using Discord and Patreon. In this episode, we discuss giving her female characters agency in a Victorian era, her brilliant tips to find an agent, how she uses fanfiction as a playground, and the long and difficult submission process she went through. But first, here's Emma with an excerpt from The Knowing.
I turned the cards. Four of Wands. The happy couple danced under their bower, the golden ink swirling around them. Hey, how do the pictures move like that? The man slurred, pointing to the cards. It's called opium, Martin, Chester said, and the room laughed. The bower broke and the secrets fell out, wisps of yellow ink bleeding into the grey smoke around us. Behind him, over Martin's shoulder, anger was taking form. The resentment of it was almost burning. I felt sweat on my brow. Still, I would not look. But when I will not speak, the cards do. You've played away, I said. She knows. The room was quiet for a second, then laughter rose again like bubbles in a glass. This is what you get, Martin, for dipping your quill all over the slums, Chester shook his head. Word travels amongst whores. Martin looked up at me, his face sallow. He didn't seem to want to hear Chester. She knows. Eight of cups reversed, I said. She's walking away. I turned the card. The eight cups emptied their blue liquid of happiness out over the wanderer, spilling them on their way. I saw it rise like steam around us, colouring the watching faces. I wondered how they couldn't taste the regret in the air, wondered how they could breathe with the malevolence that filled the room. Walking away? Martin gasped. She'll leave me? Your wife can't leave you, Chester snapped behind him, perhaps irritated at his friend's fascination, but his words were water on a stone to Martin and I, trapped in the cards with their secrets. She's no money of her own. Where would she go? Back to New Jersey? She has to, I said simply. I turned the final card over. The man juggled the many knives speared from all sides by betrayal. The Seven of Swords. She knows about her father. The shadow behind Martin was tall, now a shape in the corner of my eye, looming and reaching for me. I refused to look at it. I will not look at you. You cannot have me, or my voice. It was pressing, wrathful. My fingers trembled with the effort of not looking. Yet still the secrets travelled on the opium smoke. Angry words and fury from the long dead.
Hi, Emma. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Knowing.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here. It's so good to be here.
Thanks, Emma. So can you start by giving us a little intro to The Knowing? Tell us what it's all about.
Yeah, sure. So The Knowing is the story of a queer tattooed mystic named Flora, who is living in the slums of New York, a slum called Five Points, at the end of the 19th century. And she is in an abusive relationship with her partner called Jordan Whittaker, who is a tattoo artist and has tattooed her from head to toe all over her body. And she's stuck in this situation until one day she meets a dazzling, exciting, disabled circus performer called Minnie, who whisks her way uptown and introduces her to a whole new world and a whole new different way of being, which Flora needs to navigate using not only her wiles from living in the slums, but also her ability, her mystical abilities, and her ability to talk to ghosts.
Mm. And I wondered where this novel began, really, because I read that Flora was kind of partly inspired by a real life tattoo artist, but I know there's a lot more to this.
Yeah. When I knew pretty much from the beginning that I wanted something that was set in the 19th century. That's always been an era of history that's very important to me and interesting to me. And I write historical fiction basically across the board. That's something that I've always written. So I'm always looking to the past and reading a lot of historical fiction to find inspiration. So I knew I wanted the 19th century. I just moved to Manchester and I knew that I wanted to write about Manchester. And I started looking into that particular time period and a particular place, and I came across sort of the sideshow culture and freak shows and everything that involved. And then I started looking into who was performing to kind of get ideas of what if I had a character who was in the sideshows or the freak shows, what might they look like, what might they be like, what kind of person might they be. I already knew I wanted them to be a mystic, but I was just sort of investigating. And I got really interested in the idea of the tattooed people who were on display in Victorian freak shows. So I started looking for doing that Google type, which is like Victorian tattooed women, head to toe, blah, 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 going down all these spirals. And there were some amazing archives that helped me. But sometimes the wonder of Google is it spits out something that's only just related. And that's kind of how I came across Maud Wagner, who is not a circus performer at all, but she was one of the first female tattoo artists in New York and in America. And she lived in New York with her husband, and he was a tattooist as well, and he'd had tattooed her all over. So there's an amazing picture of her just sort of resting her head on her hands, looking down the lens of the camera in that very sort of stoic Victorian way, with all of her tattoos on display across her chest and arms. And I sort of looked at her and I was like, yeah, I want a main character who looks like that. I basically just sort of got inspired by her. The fact that she was a tattooist was really interesting to me, and that's why I wove Flora being the person who also does tattoos, as well as I wanted that sort of active agency for her. So yeah, that's where she came from, really. She was sort of a culmination of things. And then once she got on the page, she took off and sort of became herself.
I'm going to Google this picture afterwards because I'm intrigued to see what Maud looked like. I think.
She's great. It's great. Yeah, if you just type in Maud Wagner into Google and first female tattoo artist or something like that. Yeah. She wasn't the only one, obviously. There were lots of people also doing tattoos, and also in native culture in America, there are lots of people tattooing. So, yeah, but there's a great picture.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about making her a tattoo artist as well, because I've spoken to a lot of historical fiction authors, and that always the main issue seems to be with when you're wanting to write a story centered around women, how do you give them the agency in a story where the patriarchal society is so controlling and make them active? Flora doesn't have that problem. She does in some ways, but she's very active as a character. Was that a conscious thing, trying to kind of break her free of those shackles?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think possibly maybe the first draft that I wrote, one of the notes I got back from a reader, a friend who's also a writer, is that she was too passive. Like everything was happening to her and she wasn't taking control of herself. And I think a lot of the times that's easy to slip into when you are writing historical narratives, this idea that things just happen to people, and especially if they're people without power. And so then it's finding ways to give them power and give them choices in a situation where they have none or they are very limited. Generally, it does help if your characters are either very poor or very rich, because at that point in history, in the Victorian era, if you're poor, then yes, you have less systemic, you have no systemic power, really. If you want to write about somebody who has a lot of agency, you generally need to give them a lot of money. So that was the big conflict, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They don't, she doesn't have any money. And so as she finds herself in these situations with generally people who have more power than her. So how do I give her voice and agency? And on top of that, she does have a mystical power, which she's still trying to, she's learning to wield. So how do I balance those things all together?
Really? Yeah, as we're on the topic of that, and hopefully we can talk about this without kind of giving too much away, because you do have this like magical supernatural element to the novel, which is her, well, which is the title, The Knowing. How did you balance that kind of magical supernatural with the very grounded historical story?
That's a good question. I think it's something that comes naturally to me. It's the story I always want to write. I love historical fiction so much, and I have such an appreciation for people who do it incredibly well. Like sort of my literary heroes are kind of Hilary Mantel and Sarah Waters and Pat Barker, and other writers, and Deborah Levy, people who really capture the historical moment and make it come alive. I find that so powerful and wonderful to read. But I can't stop writing about magic. it always finds its way in. And I think part of that is my own kind of spirituality and my own experience of the world. I was brought up in a very evangelical Christian upbringing, and I think something that does is gives you a sense that the world is more than it is. So I've never had I didn't have like necessarily a very rational upbringing, and now that I am no longer in that religious space, I think that gives me more spiritual exploration. So maybe I think part of it is my own perspective on the world and its imaginative possibilities.
Yeah.
So maybe it's because I'm going through the world expecting or hoping to find magic, you know, in that very childlike way. So then I write it into my books as, well, it is real. It's really there. It's that wonderful moment, isn't it, that you have from childhood of you want the world to be magical, and in fiction I get to make it magical. So
yeah.
It's our world. It's just got that one thing that makes it sparkle, or in this case get very, very dark and shadowy very quickly.
Yes, absolutely. I wanted to touch on the kind of diversity of your novel, and you've got queer characters, you've got disabled characters, you have a Romany character, and obviously, again, when we talk about historical fiction, we're so used to it being very white, very straight, very masculine, I suppose. How important was it for you to fit that representation into a historical novel?
Well, I think it was really important to me because I wouldn't have written it otherwise, because the kind of historical fiction I like to read is historical fiction that is focused on bringing to life stories that have been glossed over or lost because of a white Western heteronormative patriarchal view. So I want to read stories that are about people of different cultures, you know, disabled people, queer people, women, when it comes to writing, there are things that like are not obviously not appropriate for me as a white woman, a white cis woman, to write, but I wanted to write what I could, which is, you know, queer women's experience and living with like a chronic illness and a partner with a disability, that as well. But honestly, it's not like I set out going, I'm going to write this really queer, really representative fiction, because I think if you set out from that goal, you never get anywhere. Like what I wanted to do was I wanted to write a really cool story about the things that are interesting to me. And what was interesting to me was the 19th century. And then when I started looking into freak shows, you don't have a white upper class freak. Like, they don't, that doesn't exist by the nature of the performers who were enlisted to be the freaks, you know. The whole point is they're other from traditional society. So I knew that I would be writing characters who have been othered, and characters who are, I knew it was likely I was going to be writing a disabled character, because the majority of so-called freaks in these shows were people with physical what we now would say obvious physical disabilities. And as for writing queer, like, I always write queer because I'm queer. I'm not interested necessarily in heteronormative love stories, because it doesn't, we tend to read what the romance that we experience in life.
You know, we need more historical fiction that is like this fundamentally. Like, we need these characters in fiction.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about your research, because I'm always fascinated what the point is where you almost go, okay, I've done enough research, now I'm going to write. And then obviously dip research every now and again. But did you reach a point where you kind of stopped researching, or were you just...
No. I think some people do write like that. My partner is very much research first, then write. I'm not. I'm like a chaotic kerfuffle that just kind of blusters through. I think it's because generally, like, this story, the ideas or snatches of the I write, I'm very dialogue heavy at the beginning, like, snatches of the dialogue come first. Just the ideas and bones of, like, characters or places, they usually might have started from a historical tidbit and then it flows from there, but I research as I go. It never stops, the research. It's always ongoing, and it just sort of piles up alongside, and I write and I research and I write and I research, and sometimes I'm writing more than I'm researching, and sometimes I'm researching more than I'm writing. But yeah, I don't ever have that feeling of I've done enough research and now I know enough that I can just write the book. If I start with research on the page, then it can get very exposition heavy and I need to keep it focused on the story.
Yeah.
So I might have the bare bones of a scene, like I might have dialogue and what I know the moment needs to do in terms of the narrative, and I'll have that kind of on the page, and then I will use research to flesh out and make it more real and more alive.
Sometimes that's what I found held me back sometimes when I'm trying to write something historical, where you start writing a sentence and you're like, wait, what would they be wearing, what would it feel like, what would the smell be, what's under their feet, like, and you go down all these questions, and then you kind of almost feel paralyzed. And I think your idea of writing down the bones and writing down the dialogue first and then going back and kind of filling in the details around sounds like a great way of doing it. I wondered whether, because you are also a playwright, whether the dialogue is the thing that kind of comes to you first, and that's the shape of your novel.
Yeah, dialogue always comes first. And yeah, part of that might be playwrights, my background in that. But I think the instinct kind of predates playwriting. I think it's just the way my mind works. It's quite comforting. There was in Mislexia magazine, which is like a women's writing magazine in the UK, Hilary Mantel did an interview which she talked about the Mantel method for writing. And one of the things she said there was like this idea of like being a magpie, and you just pick up bits as you go throughout the day that might like help with the book. And some one of the things she said is that snatches of dialogue will come to you. And that's very much how she talked about it as kind of like this mystical thing, you know, random things will just start dropping into your head. But that's very much how it works for me. Like, snatches of dialogue appear in the shower or while I'm making toast or tea. They just are there, and I hear the voices first and then go from there.
So you're quite instinctive in the way you write, planning or no planning, or do you write in order chronologically, or do you kind of just write what comes to you?
Now I am much more of a planner. I think at the beginning, though, of a book, it's really good to kind of keep a looseness to it. And all of this I didn't know when I was writing The Knowing, because The Knowing was my first full length novel ever. And I have since written many, many more, but like it was my first time through. And when it's your first time through ever writing a novel from beginning to end, I'd written short stories and I'd written plays, but it's not the same. You know, you've got no idea what you're doing. You don't know what the best way is to write a book because you've never done it before, and you kind of just have to bash it out and find out what works for you, and go from there. And since then, I found that in the beginning, I like to keep a like kind of looseness. I like to read a lot around, but what I like to do is just scribble. So I still write longhand, basically, and try and write as much as I can bear to longhand before I get to the point where my brain is a bit full, and then I need to put it into, I use Scrivener, so into Scrivener it goes. And then what I tend to do is do lots of graphs and timelines and historical mapping and try and get a sense of an overarching narrative, so I know where I'm going. And then I write longhand a chapter in my notebook, and then I take it onto the computer and edit it a bit and mess it around a bit, and then I write the next one longhand, and then I go back to the computer. So I switch between until I've got a full draft, and then take it to people and get their opinions and try and work back from there. But when I was doing The Knowing, I had absolutely none of that experience that I now have. I didn't even really know how important longhand writing was to me. I would be switching on the computer when I got home from work and just trying to bash things out and sort of staring at the blank page and thinking, oh God, what am I going to do? But I think the other difference is as well that when I was writing The Knowing, I was working full time. And I think it is a different beast, because often I would have long gaps between writing times. So I would write and then maybe I'd have 2 weeks where I had no time to. And so by the time I came back to it, I might have forgotten what I'd written. So I'd be rereading. But I also in those 2 weeks will have maybe gathered new ideas for where I want to take it. And so then I would be bashing out those new ideas based on something I might have scribbled down, or a note I might have taken, or something I might have read in a book or on a page, or like an article or something. So it was a very different process for The Knowing than it is now. Only slightly less chaotic.
I think that's never going to change. I think that's always going to be your way.
Yeah, probably.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'd love to hear about your kind of journey to publication. I want to touch on your fanfic writing in a bit, but obviously you've been writing for years. How did you get to this point? How did you get your agent, your book deal? How did it all work?
Yeah. So like I said, I've been writing The Known for a long time. That is partly because I was working full time, but also partly because I was also in theatre and focusing on theatre more than my novels. So I was taking big breaks in between and coming back to it. And I was also not sure how to finish a novel. So that was the thing. I knew how to finish a play, so that helped. So I started probably in 2014, and I finished a first draft all the way through, I would probably say in 2019. And that went out to some friends. And then in 2020, my great friend Rachel Mann, who is a poet and a writer and an archdeacon in the Church of England, read it for me and sat me down and ripped it to shreds.
Like all good friends do.
Yeah, and it was so necessary. And I absolutely advocate for having a person in your life, if you are a writer, who is not going to read for changing this word or changing that word or for your historical mistakes, who is going to read for your structure and for the possibility of the book, and who's going to be the person who can sit there and say, what would it be like if you just switched the orders of all the chapters, just move them all around? Or what would it be like if you wrote in a different tense or in a different point of view and just really pours boiling oil on the situation in a way that at the time will feel horrible, but will also be incredibly exciting, hopefully. That's how I always feel, is at the time there is a part of me that's intensely resistant, but then it's so incredible because you suddenly start looking at it completely differently, and it makes such a big difference. So she really helped me transform the book in 2020. And towards the end of 2020, I knew that I was done, in the sense that I knew that I could go no further on my own. And I needed an agent. I needed somebody within the industry to sort of take a look at it and get something going for me. So I entered a lot of competitions, and some of them were really helpful. And I always recommend that to novelists who are starting out. I was longlisted for the Miss Lexia competition, novel competition, which, to be honest, actually just really helped me finish the damn thing in the first place. I was also a Penguin Right Now longlisted for that. That was great, because that was the first time that anyone in the industry looked at my work, because part of the sort of prize at my stage of that competition was that I got to go to Newcastle, meet like 100 other debut novelists, sat on a table with other people who were writing historical fiction and queer historical fiction, which was great. Got like a chat from, you know, on the stage from Kirsty Logan and other authors, and then got to have like 10 minutes sat down with an editor looking at my first chapter and giving me feedback. It was so valuable. So I always recommend that as part of the process. So I was doing the competitions, and I was also getting a lot of seeking out kind of anything that was to do with agents and publications from writing platforms. So Miss Lexia were great. They run like loads of different workshops that writers can attend, the Society of Authors, anything like that, anything where I could get online for not very much money and listen to an editor or a publisher or somebody tell me stuff about the industry that was going to be helpful. I was picking up tidbits from that about how to approach agents, because I didn't know anything. You know, I knew that they were out there, these mystical beings, agents, and that I had to catch one. And I was like, what do I need? A butterfly net? I don't know. I had no clue. And doing these kind of workshops and those sorts of things, they were really helping me get a sense of how to approach them. Like I really absorbed the advice that you should look at agents specifically who are looking for something like you. Like agents will put stuff out on Twitter if they're looking, so have like know what the hashtags are and use Twitter to look for the agents, look through different agencies and read the agent bios, see what they're looking for, and then batch approach agents, you know, in batches of maybe five, send emails, wait and see what kind of feedback you get, keep track of everything, kept a spreadsheet. So I was on it. I was going into battle, the battle of finding an agent. I had a spreadsheet and everything. That was 2021. And there were real low points in that. I sent to about 50 different agents. And I think maybe after like 25, 30, I was really starting to flag.
Yeah.
And especially because the biggest thing that that you do hear from agents is it's great, it's just not for me. Mm. And that's so hard as a debut novelist, because there's nothing you can do with that. You can't go back to them and just be like, but please. and the thing about an agent is you need them to love it, you know. And at that point I didn't know how valuable that was, so part of me was just going, I don't care if you love it, please just take it. Mm-hmm. But you do need them to love it, you need them to really want to represent you and your work. And then I sent to Soho, and I actually sent to a different agent in the Soho agency, who then passed it on to my current agent, Alice Saunders. And within like 20 minutes of our first meeting, I knew that Alice was going to be the right agent for the book. And everybody said to me at the time, they were like, you only need one. You only need one. So just keep going. But oh my God, it was so disheartening at the time. And I remember that. And I'm going to be that person to other debut novelists to just be like, you have to just keep going. I'm so sorry.
It's a hard truth, isn't it, really? Because like, yeah. 50, and you almost feel like, what's the point? If 50 people don't like it, then clearly there's something wrong with it. But the reality is it's all about taste. And like you say, you just need one person that sees, but not only just sees the potential in it, but also how they can help you make it better. Because it's the right person to do that.
Yeah. And agents are not out here being like, agents love books. And that's the thing I think it's hard to internalize, but they love reading, they love books, they want books to go to the right place, and they have to love it, and they have to have a passion for it deep burning inside them. But it also needs to fit with what is going on with their agency and their list at the moment. And I sometimes got people coming back being like, this is great, but I have someone doing this right now. And that's really hard too, because then you're like, well, there's nothing I can do. Like agents only have so much time in the day, and they only have so many people on their list, and that is really hard to live with. But it does mean that when you do get the agent, they do love it.
Yeah.
And they will fight for it. Mm. And the thing I learned on my journey is that's what you really need, because it's not always easy, and it doesn't always come quickly. And the knowing did not come quickly. We sent it out into the world. We got knocked back. And so I sat down and on the back of those kind of feedbacks, Alice and I sat down, and Alice was like, so what do you want to do? There seems to be a theme in some of the feedback here. Do you want to make some changes? Do you want to go back into the manuscript and give it another work over and we'll go out again? And I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And that was most of my 2022 was taking the feedback, reworking the manuscript over the summer, then resubmitting, and then going through the process of meeting publishers and getting rejected by publishers and having it almost work out with publishers and then being absolutely heartbroken when it doesn't work out with publishers. It was a real, that was kind of my summer/autumn of 2022. And oh my God, I cannot tell you how heartbroken I was.
When
there was a particular publisher who they were really, they loved it, but it just didn't work out in terms of the, and it wasn't to do with me or the manuscript, it was to do with the internal goings on of what was going on with the publisher and the books that they had and what they needed at the time for their organization, and it had nothing to do with me. And in it, that's what made it so sad and so heartbreaking in my end, because when there's something you can control, you're like, well, if they don't like the character, maybe I can fix the character. But when it's nothing to do with you, that it's just absolutely a kick to the head. And that's why it's so important to have an agent that loves your work and goes, I'm going to keep selling, I'm going to keep pushing. And absolute credit to Alice, that's what she kept doing. And we had a real lull at the end of 2022. And the list of people that were reading the manuscript was getting smaller and smaller. And people kept passing. And I remember I had to have this conversation with Alice where I was just like, what happens if no one takes it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't, that's the other thing as well, as a debut novelist, I didn't know, you know? And there is so much that's unclear about the industry as in your first time, and you're learning everything as you go. And the thing that you learn is that there's a route that you are kind of expected to take, which is you get your agent and then the agent sends out the book and then hopefully you get a publisher and that's your first book. And then you get to write a second one, hopefully, if the publisher likes you. So there's a route. Nobody talks necessarily about what happens if the route doesn't work. And so I had to have this conversation with Alice. What happens if no one takes it? And Alice was amazing and really honest and was just like, I will keep selling it. It's not going to stop my end. I will keep putting it out, but I will also sell whatever you write next. And that was very much a moment of, I have to write something else now. And I have to write something else with this feeling of kind of incompleteness inside me, that the knowing doesn't have a home and maybe it never will. And I just have to try again and write another book. And I actually wrote three. I had a wildly productive 6 months, which is partly like disassociated panic and terror that it wasn't going to work and that nobody was going to publish me and my dreams were going to be completely dashed and we had no money. So I was like, I'm just going to write so hard. And then, you know, it was like magic. One day it happened very fast, but Alice had also been aware that we'd had a couple of blowbacks and I was, you know, a bit fragile with it. So I think she had waited until it was sure and then sent me the email being like, this is Bedford Square. They want this. They want you. This is how much they're offering. This is the deal, rather than sending me an email being like, I've had some interest from. And then it all happened really, really quickly. But yeah, it can be a real up and down. So you need people who are going to love your work and are going to stand in your corner and just be like, whatever you write, I'm going to try and sell it. Whatever you do, I'm here. I believe in you and I believe in this book. And even if it takes me 10 years to sell it, I'll still believe in it. And that's really important. Yeah. Sorry, that was a very long story.
Those kind of stories always are, because I think, A, it takes a long time. B, it's not always a straightforward route. And what I was thinking as you were talking about the kind of agent rejections, that it's then very similar when you have to go through the submission process. And again, it's about the right fit and the right editor. And there might be things that get in the way. Like I remember having one editor really liking the book, but unfortunately there was already another book that was going to be published by them that they said similar. And so then they didn't buy my book. And now I've heard recently that a lot of the time that sales teams can be a lot more involved in acquisitions, and so there's so many different hoops to jump through before a book can be published. And one thing I would say, and you kind of brought it up there with your talk with your agent, is find out what is going to happen if your book doesn't sell, and ask that when you're kind of looking for an agent, and find out whether they kind of swiftly move on with and get rid of you, or whether they want to stand by you, because I think that's really important. One of your passions we have to talk about is your fan fiction. I know you're super prolific. You've written basically more novels than I can count, just through
your passion,
basically.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. How's that made you a better writer?
I don't know that it has. Like, fanfic is where like all of my worst habits as a writer come out, because it's just a playground, you know. It's not, I'm not editing it, I'm not really I mean, I am editing, like, in a sense, but not really. It's just sort of a fun space to play in, and just, you know, do my correction of a book that I read when I was a kid. No, I don't think it has made me a better technical writer or creator of narrative in any way. I do think it has made me stronger as a writer because of the amount of criticism that can come. And it's a very, fanfic is like one of the only spaces where, as a writer, you directly, you don't have to, but it's very hard to ignore the engagement of an everyday reader. Because it's right there, so it's connected to your account, it's in your inbox. In my case, it's like sliding into your DMs on Instagram and Twitter, you know. Because I'm connected across these platforms, so people do seek me out, sometimes aggressively, through whatever means necessary, to ask questions or to give opinions, unsolicited or otherwise. So it allowed me the space to get used to that, to the idea that people are going to read and they're going to have their opinion, and not bear so much on their opinions in that way. And it's not like I haven't engaged with people's opinions in the past, but usually that's been in kind of like a critical literary way, especially like coming from doing a master's at university. You know, you sit down if you're in a creative writing course, you sit down 3 times a week and 7 people tear your work to shreds, but they do it very critically. With a view to considering your writing and you as a writer. They're not sort of trolling you on a massive platform and calling you a bad person because a character died. You know, it's a very different mode of engagement. But I think it has been good for me. And I've learned a lot from it. And so whilst it's not necessarily made me a better writer, it has made me a stronger one. I have more courage of my own convictions in what I write. I care less about what people think of me because I write. I don't really give that time of day. And I also can see, the lovely thing is being able to see how transformative fiction can be for people. Like, that's been so beautiful. Like, yeah, I've had some not great people and some not great experiences, but I've also overwhelmingly had positive ones. It would be wrong to like suggest in any way that my overall experience of writing fanfic and having an unexpectedly popular fanfic in my life has been a negative thing. Like, people say such meaningful things about the work, that like, it's, you know, it's helping them through depression, it's, you know, even like really extreme things, like it's stopping them from hurting themselves, and it's always giving them a way to grieve, or it's helping them understand their sexuality, or helping them understand their own childhood trauma. Like, these are massive, massive things, and there is like a burden in that, in hearing those stories from people that you've never met, because like that kind of power is like, oh my god. But that's a good lesson too, because then I learned that I'm not responsible for any of these people. Like, it's really wonderful when they take something positive away from it. Like, of course, that's what I want. But ultimately, I'm not writing anything for anybody else. Mm. Like, I'm writing for myself. And I would be writing all the same, even if nobody was reading. And that has been a really important journey that I don't think I would have learned until much later without fanfic. So I'm grateful for those journeys and those lessons. I think they're standing me in good stead for whatever's coming. And I have absolutely no desire to ever look at Goodreads for this reason. So yeah, it's helping, I think.
So finally, can you give us a little tease about what you're working on next?
I'm writing. I'm writing, and yeah, and I'm gonna hopefully have some really fun announcements this year, which I'm really excited about. But yeah, I am writing. There are more books coming, and there is more history, there is more darkness, there is more magic.
Brilliant. Well, that's exactly what we're looking forward to. Emma, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was Emma Hines talking about her historical novel, The Knowing, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code MOM.